Hi, you're listening to Deep Fried Planet on Resonance FM. That's 104.4 FM. This is Josh Garman, and we're going to be talking about direct action on climate change. You may remember that in 2008, there was quite an iconic court case where six Greenpeace activists, the so-called King's North Six, climbed up the chimney of a coal-fired power station, did £30,000 of criminal damage, admitted to it, went to court and were found not guilty on the argument that they were acting to try and stop climate change. It was described by the New York Times as one of the ideas that changed the world, and not least because the director of NASA, Professor James Hansen, one of the world's most famous climate scientists, was one of their expert witnesses who testified to their defence. Well, in the last month, there's been another of these court cases up at Aberdeen, where a bunch of plain stupid activists broke onto a runway of Aberdeen Airport to protest against the airport expansion and to try and stop carbon emissions there. They mounted a similar defence, and we'll be speaking to a couple of the defendants. But before we speak to them, I'll introduce Graham Thompson. Ben Stewart is away this week. So we got Graham, which is great because we're talking about direct action, and the Evening Standard once described Graham Thompson as the daddy of direct action. He's climbed on the roof of Parliament and broken onto runways before. Graham, welcome.
Thanks very much, Joss. Nice to be here.
So we'll be speaking in a minute to Dan Glass, who is one of the activists involved in the case up at Aberdeen, and also Tilly Gifford, who hit the front page of The Guardian a few months ago when it was revealed that police were trying to bribe her with thousands of pounds to testify against Dan and other people in the activist community in Scotland.
Yeah, there's been a lot of infiltration problems in Plain Stupid, which they've dealt with extremely well, largely by getting double-page spreads about them. So I think the police are probably less enthusiastic about approaching them now, but it was an interesting case.
Well, let's speak to Tilly about that in a minute. But before we do, hi, Dan, are you there?
Hello, how are you?
Good, thanks. So you broke onto an airport runway at Aberdeen?
At Aberdeen taxiway, yeah, last March 2009. And just come out nearly the other end of the trial to do with it.
And so how many people were there who did it?
There was nine of us, seven on the taxiway at Aberdeen Airport and two on the roof at Aberdeen Airport.
And so you shut it for quite a while, didn't you?
We shut the airport for approximately 5 hours. And that may sound quite extreme, but our intentions were to stop as many carbon emissions as possible. The group we were doing the action with was Plain Stupid, and Plain Stupid's one of the main motivations is to stop runaway climate change. So we were saying enough's enough and stopping emissions at their source to tackle the airport expansion policies in the UK.
So people know a little bit about Plain Stupid because they'll have seen them on the news and seen the sort of direct action at Stansted and at the Houses of Parliament and things. But I guess what's interesting about your case in particular is the court case, because you tried to mount the same sort of defence that they used down at King's North, didn't you?
Similar defence. In Scotland, we don't have lawful excuse, which the ability to use it as a defence as they did at King's North 6.
And so that's the defence where they say, we can do this because we had lawful excuse because we were trying to stop something that was worse.
Yep, stop a higher crime. And the lawful excuse was also used at the EDO decommissioner's case recently in Brighton against the arms manufacturer. So we don't have that in Scotland. And the other difference is necessity, again, stopping a higher crime, taking immediate action to stop the loss to life, is much narrower in Scotland. So if we were to use that defence at our trial at the Climate Nine, you would have to almost, and it's very difficult, to directly prove that the emissions that we stopped from those planes not taking off directly saved this family's life in Bangladesh or wherever. So it's much narrower, and it's quite exhausting even trying to have to prove that when you shouldn't have to, because we know that every ton of carbon emissions not being emitted is a good thing and saves life in the long run, but you have to be very specific. So we didn't use the necessity defence. our advocates and our legal team went down the route of breach of peace, that we should be allowed to freely express, freely assemble, using Human Rights Convention Article 10 and 11. We're taking peaceful action on such an important issue as climate change, then we should be allowed to. So it's very interesting. All our vandalism charges were dropped, and we were left with breach of the peace. This was the first time climate change had been brought in front of a jury, a climate change action in Scotland, the first time, I believe, in the UK since Copenhagen. For 2 weeks, we were talking about the importance of taking action on climate change, how the law doesn't encompass wider environmental rights, the importance of civil disobedience. And then the jury were out for 4 hours, and it wasn't unanimous. So it's
I remember the around the time of the defence of the Greenpeace activist down at King's North, the Daily Mail newspaper said that when they got found not guilty, it was like legitimising anarchy. And it sounds like, from the verdict you got of guilty, that's what the people of Aberdeen thought.
That they were going to... Well, that's an interesting concept, because what there was a lot of discussion amongst the courtroom about elasticising the notion of breach of peace. And whilst, you know, in an ideal society, young people, people who care about climate change, shouldn't have to invade an airport to stop a higher problem. We shouldn't have to do that. We shouldn't have to do that on a freezing cold morning in March in Aberdeen. but we have to, and because we see that there are bigger issues at play, so that's where their concern, understandably, was coming from. But what our advocates were arguing was that, yeah, we did breach the bylaws of the airport, but we didn't breach peace. Because in order to breach the peace, you have to cause potential to fear and alarm for the local and the wider community. And we went into the airport when it was closed.
Dan, on the subject of the local community, Aberdeen's a big oil town, isn't it?
Certainly is. Yes, it's the self-titled oil capital of Europe. It was very interesting, the judge at one point, when he realised that, you know, the climate change was going to be discussed at such a level in his courtroom, he said, and this was in Aberdeen, and it really made me think, he said, I do not want to use my courtroom to dispute that climate change is man-made. Let's not waste time doing that. Let's talk about whether this was a breach of peace or not, and whether they were justified in their actions. And I was thinking, are you really saying that, being one of the top sheriffs in the self-titled capital of Europe? But maybe that shows that there just isn't time or need to discuss or debate whether it's man-made or not, because we know that it is.
Yeah, indeed. And it's quite encouraging to find out that the oil capital of Europe is catching up with that as well. But unfortunately, not quite enough to acquit you in this case. Do you think that the necessity defence still has some scope in Scotland?
Well, there'll be a long way to go, because it's so much narrower in Scotland than in England. But I think, you know, these things take a long time. And whilst we shouldn't all spend a year and a half involved in court-based activism, these things slowly push the goalposts. And, you know, 50 years down the line, we might be in a very, very different place. And there's continuous discussions between the English legal system and the Scottish legal system about which precedents are being set and what impact that has for everyone else. But relating back to the Aberdeen oil workers, one thing which, again, keeps things moving forward and, you know, opens the goalposts and gets more people involved is the amount of support that we were getting from all around the world. But particularly, a lot of our support came from workers involved in high-emission industries. In the oil industry, some people in the aviation industry, in the aeronautical engineering industry. So it was very interesting, because the very people who, you know, are at the forefront of vulnerability in terms of what's going to happen being involved in a, you know, a carbon-intensive industry, were the very people supporting us. And that was very inspiring to see. So if more unexpected alliances and more people who you wouldn't expect to raise their voice and support us come out, and that is only going to push things further and make things easier next time there's another climate change trial in Scotland.
Well, Dan, we're going to be speaking to Corinne in a little while, who was involved with organising some of your support when you were in court. But is Tilly with you there?
Tilly is with me. Do you want to have a word?
I'll have a quick word with her.
Yeah, sure. I'll just pass you over.
Hello, how's it going?
All right, how are you?
Yes, all right. Good, well.
Hi, Tilly. So a few months ago, you were in The Guardian because it was revealed by the newspaper that police were trying to bribe you for information about other activists in Scotland, which, whilst it was a few months ago, I guess is still quite interesting in the context of this court case.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's entirely relevant to this court case, not least because one of the most exciting things about the court case, I mean, regardless of the verdict and everything else that was achieved in between and all the alliances it made, was that it was actually established in the courtroom that that BAA were lying to the police. It was always made out for the whole since the action happened that we delayed an emergency medical flight, an emergency air ambulance, which was trying to take off. And for several reasons, it seemed very clear at the time that was not the case. And throughout the process of the court case, it was established that there was never any emergency or ambulance. It was a scheduled medical flight which we were not preventing from taking off, and we got a really clear statement from the head of the air ambulance company saying they did not cause this delay and we refused to take up complaint with the protesters.
So Tilly, be clear on that, so are you saying that it looks as though the police invented an emergency in order to get you off the runway?
In this case, it isn't the police, it would be BAA, who gave erroneous information, and either that's on purpose or it is lost in translation, but essentially emotional blackmail was used to get us off the runway. We could have stayed there for hours and hours and hours, and that was our plan. It was to stop as many carbon emissions as possible on that day. And the only reason that we dismantled was because we did finally get their confirmation that we were holding back an emergency an ambulance, and obviously human welfare is at the core of what we do. We wouldn't want to endanger anyone's life. And so that's when we dismantled the Harris fencing and put an end to our protest. And it only emerged later that that was a scheduled medical flight and it could have taken off. It did take off whilst we're still on the runway.
Sorry, one other little point. You say dismantled the Harris fencing. Some of the listeners probably don't really know what you're referring to. What does that mean?
Right, okay. We erected four pieces of Harris fencing and locked ourselves to the inside of it. And so these are kind of very safe, non-violent ways of shutting down an airport or other kinds of carbon-heavy infrastructure.
So you built your own cage on the runway, basically, so you could hold the position. Oh, clever.
Well, Tilly and Dan, thanks a lot for joining us. Sorry we haven't got longer to talk about it.
Okay, that was brilliant. Good, lovely to speak to you.
And you.
Bye,
cheers.
Tilly.
Hi.
Hi, Corinne. This is Joss here on Resonance FM with Graham.
Hello, hi.
So you work for the Gaia Foundation. Can you tell us a bit about who the organisation is and what they do?
Yes, I work as a legal researcher for the Gaia Foundation, which is a charity based in London. And for the last 25 years, we've been working with Indigenous and local communities, mainly in Africa, South America, Asia and Europe, to regenerate healthy ecosystems, so rivers and forests and land, and enhance traditional knowledge and practices. So that helps them become secure in their land and food and water, and also helps them build community self-governance.
Right, so we just spoke to Dan and Tilly, who were obviously two of the activists who broke onto the runway at Aberdeen Airport. And it was actually Dan who suggested that you join us on the show, because he said that you were really instrumental in gathering support from around the world for the defendants. Can you tell us a bit about who you managed to get supporting them?
Yes, the Gaia team and our international networks, mainly the African Biodiversity Network, have been instrumental in showing their support for Climate 9. And it's ranged from countries in Africa to Asia and Europe. And they've been sending in their sort of statements of support.
So would that be community leaders from those areas rather than the kind of, activists that you're working with?
Yeah, it includes communities, policymakers, lawyers, a range of people that have been affected by climate change. For example, in Kenya, the organisation called ICE, the Institute for Culture and Ecology, and they've been severely affected by drought, but they've been also building their community resilience by reviving traditional farming practices. So they're like a positive story of change. And so we've been trying to get Climate Nine in touch with these communities around the world to support their campaign.
So is the idea to sort of turn the Aberdeen Climate Nine in a court case into a sort of iconic case?
That's right. The Climate Nine case was the first in Scotland, first direct action case in Scotland, and it set the precedent for communities and activists anywhere around the world, because it's a way of challenging unjust laws that are promoting the interests of, you know, economics above social justice and the rights of the earth. So it's a really important case, and Gaia and our international networks were very supportive of the case.
I suppose it makes sense to have witnesses from around the world in this kind of case, because of course climate change isn't something that's only going to affect Aberdeen. And in the Kingsnorth case, there were witnesses from various parts around the world. I think, was there an Inuit leader at the Kingsnorth
case?
Yeah,
there was the leader of the Inuit indigenous people in Greenland gave evidence for the Greenpeace activist down at Kingsnorth. But also Jeff Meaden, who was a professor of geography in Kent, who's an expert on the impacts of climate change in Britain, gave evidence in the Kingsnorth case, and I gather he gave evidence up in Aberdeen as well. But, Corinne, if you're a legal researcher working on these cases around the world of impacts of climate change, does that mean that there are similar kind of legal challenges and legal cases going on in other countries?
Yes. For example, in the US, there was a case, various cases. One was called Massachusetts, and they were community took an action against the, I think, Environmental Protection Agency to end.
Was this about classification of CO2 or?
Sorry?
Was this about classification of CO2? Because there's been a lot of fuss with the Environmental Protection Agency about whether or not they can regulate CO2 as a dangerous gas or not.
Yes, that's right. That was one of the important cases about that, and they found the government did have a duty to reduce CO2 as a dangerous gas. And so they've often classified CO2 as like a public nuisance or a gas and a dangerous gas, and have allowed communities to take action on behalf of the wider public.
So there's been some real legal changes as a consequence of that. That's fantastic.
Corinne, I think we're going to have to wrap up there because we're running out of time and we've got another guest to speak to. But thanks very much. And it is pretty interesting how increasingly activists, both from across the spectrum really, from the Obama administration trying to go to the Supreme Court to regulate greenhouse gases using EPA rules, environmental protection rules, through to activists in Scotland, through to, you know, communities in Africa, it shows how the activist movement are really using the law.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
Cheers.
Take care. Bye.
So as well as the direct action we've seen from Plain Stupid up at Aberdeen in recent months and their recent court case, in response to the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, there's been an increasing amount of direct action just in the last few weeks, but mostly targeting the Tate, the art gallery in London. So joining us is James Marriott from the environmental group Platform, who's been involved with the campaign there. Hi, James.
Hi there, Josh. How are you doing?
All right. How are you?
Good.
So tell us a bit about why you're targeting the Tate.
The Tate has been targeted because it's one of a number of institutions which is sponsored by BP. BP sponsors a whole range of what one might call the establishment cultural highlights: the Tate, the National Portrait Gallery, British Museum, the Royal Opera House, the Cultural Olympiad, which is part of the Olympics, the Almeida, and as well as the Natural History Museum, the Science Museum, and the National Maritime Museum, and the National Theatre. All of these are in some way or other, or have in the last decade, been sponsored by BP, and Shell has sponsored several of them as well as a number of others. And the reason why action has been taken against the Tate in the most recent period is because we want to draw attention to the fact that these institutions are helping create what we call the social license to operate of BP, helping to not just consume oil, but helping to extract oil. And, of course, a lot of people are extremely...
Can you go into a bit more detail about what you mean by the social license?
Well, any oil company, indeed any company, needs to have either the passivity or the support of those people who surround its oil installations or its marketplaces. So if it doesn't have that, it has a real problem. I mean, the most obvious example is, say, for example, in the Delta, the Niger Delta, where there's no social license to operate for Shell. It doesn't have the local support, and it has a constant problem with kidnapping and disruption of its production processes. That's a very extreme example. Now, all companies try to avoid such things happening, and they have to create that support. They have to create passive support in a very concrete way. It's like extracting oil. They have to extract that support.
So is this a bit like getting legitimacy, to be able to see as a legitimate operation that are behaving within the law in a responsible and respectable manner? Is that, that's the kind of thing you're talking about?
Yes, it is. I think it's a bit more active than legitimacy. It's actually building that sense of support from a population in any particular country. But more, the reason why it's active, it's actually utilize the sponsorship of things like the Tate are utilized to build those relationships.
I was about to mention, it's interesting, all the ones you listed, the Opera House, the Tate, various, they all seem very London-based, and they all seem fairly kind of, well, I wouldn't say elite, maybe, but, I mean, they're not sponsoring Coronation Street, are they? They're sponsoring the Opera.
Absolutely.
Why is that?
Well, I mean, it is very interesting. I mean, the logic of the thing would, if you looked at an oil company, you'd think, well, they want lots and lots of people to buy petrol, so they would advertise in the most popular newspapers like The Sun or News of the World, and they would support things like football teams or things which have a mass following.
Yeah,
and
that would
drive people to go, oh, I'd like BP and I'll buy petrol. But they're basically not interested in selling petrol in that way. They make very little money, actually, at the pumps. What they're crucially interested in is getting the political support of the political elites of countries. And in this country, one of the ways to do that is through cultural support. So you give money to the Tate, you have events at the Tate where there's you can meet senior figures from the Foreign Office, or you can hold events where you can meet major cultural figures.
So this isn't just a kind of generalised PR exercise. This is also about networking. It's about providing...
Actually, Graham, I saw in the Guardian the other day that Greenpeace had got hold of some emails between BP's head of government affairs and the secretary to the environmental commissioner in Europe, in which they said, if you ever have an urge for the Opera, do let us know. Which I guess vindicates your point somewhat, James.
It's exactly a really good example. One very rarely sees this kind of thing in that detail, but it's happening all the time. It's about building that support. That's the most useful thing that the company can do. And if you ever wonder, is it worth it, consider the way in which in the last 2 months you've seen the British political establishment come out in support of BP and question Obama's enunciations about the company's behavior and profits. I mean, so you had the Mayor of London saying, oh, no, don't bash BP. You had Lord Tebbit, you had other members of the House of Lords, you had the business ministers, you had the DEC, you had the Prime Minister, a whole range of politicians coming out and going, don't bash BP, it's a great and important British institution. And one of the ways in which it creates that impression that it's a great and important British institution is through its relationship to cultural institutions.
I guess that even, I mean, some might say that they're doing that because their shareholders or their friends are, but actually, I mean, would they do that for British American Tobacco, even if they were shareholders? And of course, tobacco sponsorship has been severely curtailed.
I think, yeah, tobacco and arms are the ones that tend to get identified as sort of persona non grata in terms of art sponsorship. I guess you're trying to add oil to that list, would that be right?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, if you were a Martian, you came to this city, London, you'd look around and you'd see all these things sponsored and you go, oh, this must be an oil city. Now, most people who walk around London don't think of themselves as living in an oil city. They think of an oil city as being Kuwait or Houston or whatever. But actually, London is one of the most important centres for the oil industry globally, both from the political support that it can garner here from one of the key players on the Security Council, but when secondly, from the financial structures that exist in this city. If we're going to get anywhere near a low-carbon economy, if we're going to get anywhere near a world which is not dependent on fossil fuels, the position of the oil and gas companies having a dominant position in the cultural institutions of this country has to go. It absolutely has to go. Completely. You know, we've driven tobacco out of the support of cultural institutions, and that in a sense was a precursor to trying to build national health a bit better and less dependency on tobacco.
I guess it's unfortunate timing for you though, in the sense that when the arts, like everything else, is facing severe cuts in public spending, they're going to need the support of private companies. So if they don't get it from BP, do you have a preference from where they should be getting it?
Well, I think the key thing is for the cultural institutions to have the courage to say, actually, you know, what we're doing is important. You know, we can get the support from a number of different places, both the state or from perhaps other companies, and we don't need to do this. They have the courage to say we don't need to have tobacco sponsorship, and now's the time to say we don't need to have oil and gas sponsorship. I mean, it's very interesting, I think, that in the last couple of weeks since the actions that took place in the Tate, you've seen a great upwelling of response from the kind of cultural sector commentators saying, oh, you can't bash this, you know, you can't question cultural sponsorship. But I believe that you absolutely have to, and it's very, very important. I would say that it's not just happened in the last period. Art Not Oil have been campaigning about cultural sponsorship by the oil and gas sector since around about June 2003 and scored some notable successes driving out Shell sponsorship of the Wildlife Photography Award at the National Natural History Museum. Shell eventually had to drop that support. And I hope that we can see that kind of shift taking place in other cultural institutions in the very near future.
Great. Thanks a lot, James. I think we've run out of time there. But thanks for joining us.
Great.
Yeah, thanks, James.
Bye.
So we've heard about direct action up in Scotland and down in London at the Tate. And that's all we've got time for this week. But I think we'll be hearing more about the direct action movement on climate change this summer, because just in a couple of weeks' time, there's the next Camp for Climate Action, which is happening in Edinburgh this year. You'll remember that's when hundreds of activists camp outside major polluting industries. So they were outside Heathrow, outside King's North, and this year they're outside the Royal Bank of Scotland, that bank that we own 84% of, but that still supports fossil fuel projects around the world. They're saying that they should turn it into the Royal Bank of Sustainability. But anyway, maybe we'll talk about that on one of our future shows. So for this week, this is Joss Garman.
Graham.
And this is Resonance FM. Thanks very much. Thank you.